Court will proceed to the third case of the day, Schweiner versus Humphreys. Mr. Hennick.
May it please the Court. My name is Robert Hennick. I represent Robert Schweiner on this habeas appeal. Mr. Schweiner was charged and convicted of repeated sexual assault of the same child, which under Wisconsin law requires proof beyond a reasonable doubt of three separate, in this case, sexual contacts. The issue before the Court is whether Mr. Schweiner is entitled to habeas relief on the grounds that the jury instructions, and more specifically the supplemental jury instructions, failed to meet the constitutional requirement of requiring proof beyond a reasonable doubt of all facts necessary for conviction. The reason why we submit that that failed is because the jury instructions permitted a single touching, simultaneous touching of the complainant's vagina and buttocks to count as two of the three sexual contacts.
That presupposes that they were simultaneous, and that it assumes a fact, not an evidence.
No, I believe that it doesn't. The issue here, as viewed by the Court of Appeals, was whether the jury could have reached the correct result. My argument here is that the Constitution, the due process requirements under Corella and California v. Roy and Apprendi, requires that the jury instructions require the finding. Now, in this case, it's undisputed, number one, that Wisconsin law requires that under Wisconsin law, the simultaneous touching is but a single contact. It's undisputed also that the jury instructions permitted the jury to take one toss and divide that into two separate sexual contacts. Sometimes that will be appropriate, as the Court of Appeals explained in this case. If there is sufficient time, if there is a between the two touchings, if there is time for thought and deliberation, then there can be two separate touchings out of a single toss. What my argument here is that under the facts of this case, a jury reasonably could view those facts as any tossing was, in fact, simultaneous. We look at Mark's testimony, which described the tossings as grabbing a hold of her arm, one hand under the butt, and throwing her. No hesitation, no fiddling around, nothing like that. The prosecutor, in closing arguments, described it exactly the same way. So we have the facts that a reasonable jury could view this as simultaneous. We have the instruction that allows the jury to take the simultaneous touching and count it as two separate contacts for purposes of the
But not if the jury concluded that it was simultaneous. The jury was clearly instructed that it had to find three.
Yes.
And that there were four possibilities here, factually. But there wasn't any kind of mandatory presumption employed here about whether the two from the same quarry incident were in fact simultaneous or not.
Right.
That was a factual question for the jury to resolve, so I don't see the problem.
It is a factual decision for the jury to resolve, or a factual dispute for the jury to resolve, based on instructions that tell it what it is supposed to resolve. In this case, the jury was never told that the simultaneous touching of the two body parts only counts as one. What we have is a jury question, which indicates that at least one of the jurors had problems with something in the case, and it was important to that juror, and possibly more, whether the single toss would count as one or two sexual contacts. And what the jury was told is touching of the buttocks is one, touching of the vagina the first time is two. It was never told the requirements under Hirsch and Kohler that if it's simultaneous, you can't count it as two. And that's what our argument is. Under Corella, under California v. Roy, under Apprendi, the jury instructions have to require proof beyond a reasonable doubt.
So if I can focus this a little more, your argument is that there should have been this simultaneity instruction?
Yes. For instance, we can't just go into a jury instructions and say you have to find the actus reus and you have to find the mens rea, go forth and deliberate. We have to explain what it is the jury has to find. And in this particular case, since the facts would allow a jury to find simultaneousness or simultaneity, they had to be told in order to require them to find every fact necessary for conviction. They have to be told what the law is that they need to apply to these facts.
But your client didn't object to the...
No, he did not.
To the second instruction, and he didn't affirmatively ask for a simultaneous instruction.
True. He did not. And that was why we raised ineffectiveness of counsel in the state court and also in the district court here. At no point did the state respond with waiver. At no point did the state court or the court below respond with waiver. They addressed our constitutional argument head on. So therefore, the...
But it would be the next question for this court if we were to find that there should have been some further instruction, whether it was waived, correct?
I think waiver would be a procedural default argument concerning state court. And since the state courts did not...
They didn't have to reach it, though, did they? Because they had found there wasn't an error in instruction.
Well, but under Harris v. Reed, it's a procedural default only if the state court actually relied on it. And if the state court did not rely on this procedural default, which is what waiver is,
But that would mean that the state court would have to, even when they find that there was no error, they would have to also find that even if there was error, it was waived.
Yes.
Otherwise, it's not preserved for any further consideration by any court.
The Supreme Court said in Harris v. Reed, yes. Also, we would note that the state never raised it, so that issue was waived before this court. I also would note that the state didn't raise it until we received a limited certificate of appealability that struck out the issue of ineffective assistance of counsel. So if the court decides to go in the area of waiver despite Harris and waiver by the state, I would ask that we be allowed to file supplemental briefs on that particular issue. We were not able to do that in this case because we only received a certificate of appealability on the strict due process issue. Now, obviously...
Ms. Hannick, could I ask you just a factual question? I appreciate your argument on the simultaneous and whether or not the jury was correctly instructed. But doesn't this record reflect enough instances that even if they divided that into two, the jury inappropriately, we'd have three events, I guess, that would satisfy the statute?
Yes, the Court of Appeals recognized that there were actual multiple tossings. So if the jury had been instructed that it could use the multiple tossings, then that is, you know, possibly something that could have been a basis for conviction. However, that takes us still back to the same thing. The jury could have found that they were separate touchings. The jury could have found that the multiple tossings were a basis for it, but the jury instructions did not require them to do that, and that's where the constitutional violation arises. I see that I'm into my rebuttal time, so thank you very much.
Thank you. Mr. Neuser?
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Mark Neuser. I represent the respondent in this matter. This court should affirm the district court's decision denying habeas relief to Mr. Schweiner for three reasons. Number one, Mr. Schweiner presents no evidence, much less clear and convincing evidence, as would be required under the AEDPA standard of review, that the state appellate court's determination that Schweiner separately touched the victim's vagina and buttocks during their first visit to the quarry was an unreasonable determination of the facts. Number two, no clearly established federal law, as recognized by the United States Supreme Court, has recognized a due process right to an unrequested instruction that would actually have undermined the defense theory at trial. The defense theory at trial here was that no sexual contact whatsoever happened.
It wouldn't have undermined it if the jury had been instructed as to what they needed to find, because that would have been the court giving that instruction. it wouldn't have undermined the defense theory that none of the events happened, just for them to prevail perforce that a specific one happened at the same time.
I'm not so certain of that. I think that the entire defense theory was this was all innocent horseplay and wrestling. And, in fact, Mr. Schweiner testified to that at trial. He chose to take the stand and say none of this touching ever occurred. If the trial court had suddenly, during the middle of jury instructions, injected an instruction that said, well, sexual touching at the first visit to the quarry, this is how you should divide it up, I think that would have undermined the defense theory at trial. And again, this was not something that the defendant ever requested. I think that in order to find that there was a due process violation here, you would have to find that the trial court had some sort of a duty, a constitutional duty, as set forth by a case of the United States Supreme Court, that he should have been able to divine this possible defense that post-conviction counsel would come up with years and years later, and that, frankly, is not supported by the record as found by all the state courts who have looked at this case.
And I think the response, if I understood it, is that it's too late. That's essentially a waiver argument, and it's too late for us to consider that.
I'm not so sure that's true. Now we're getting into whether or not we've waived a waiver argument, and that seems a tad overly fussy, number one.
Well, what about Harris v. Reed? Is he right that that restricts our ability to take it up at this point?
No, I don't think that's true. My argument is not so much waiver. It's from a practical standpoint, it seems unwise for this court to rule that the trial court should have divined this instruction when it was never presented to the trial court as a defense theory at all. It really isn't so much a technical waiver argument as really what are we to expect trial courts to do, number one. And number two, what U.S. Supreme Court case would specifically instruct trial courts to submit this type of instruction? I mean, it would be the equivalent of, let's say there was a murder case, and it's arguable, and the entire defense at trial was that the defendant never did it. The defendant took the stand, said, I was not there, I never did it. But it's arguable that the evidence could suggest that potentially there's a self-defense instruction to be had out there. Defense counsel never requested it. It's never a theory at trial.
That analogy doesn't work here, because to get a self-defense instruction, the defendant has to admit the conduct. And the same is not true in a sexual assault. He's entitled to deny that any of this happened, but also insist that the instructions be correct.
Well, okay, I withdraw the inapt analogy, but I do still submit that it would be an awful lot to expect a trial judge to have divined the need for this instruction here, especially, and again, I want to go back to the findings of fact that we have from the Court of Appeals. That was glossed over in Mr. Schweiner's argument, but the Court of Appeals ruled, and this is paragraph 17 of its decision, most importantly, Danielle's testimony indicated that when he tossed her, Schweiner's hand would rub and squeeze on her buttocks and then would kind of go like towards the front, referring to her vagina. This evidence indicates that even if both contacts occurred within the context of a single toss, Schweiner engaged in two separate volitional acts, including a conscious decision to squeeze and rub Danielle's buttocks with his hand and a conscious decision to move his hand forward to touch her vagina before tossing her. Now, this court has held in the Mendelia case that I cited in my brief that state court appellate findings are entitled to deference just like trial court findings are. That is a finding of fact by the Wisconsin Court of Appeals. The Court of Appeals also noted, as Your Honor previously mentioned, that there were lots of ways that this jury could have gotten to the magical number three in order to sustain this conviction. The evidence was there for the jury to conclude that there were multiple tosses during this first visit to the quarry, and the victim testified that on virtually every toss, this groping occurred. So the jury could very well have decided we have two contacts by virtue of this first visit to the quarry, because every time he tossed her, he was touching her inappropriately. These are findings of fact by the state courts, and they are presumed correct unless Schweiner clearly and convincingly rebuts them, and he can't.
It's my understanding that the state's theory of this prosecution evolved during the course of the trial, that when it began, it was really three discrete instances,
right,
two separate visits to the quarry, and then a third instance of sexual assault that occurred at an apartment, apparently.
Right.
And as the testimony revealed there was a possible alternative state's theory for this, which broke up the first quarry visit into two possible sexual assaults instead of one. And that's where this change in theory occurred and the problem with the jury instructions arguably crept in. Is that fair to say?
Yes.
And so the opening statement in the pretrial position of the state was different from its closing argument and the position that it took on how the jury should be given the supplemental instruction when the question came during deliberations.
But I don't think mutually exclusive. In other words, I don't think they directly contradicted each other. But it's true to say that the state's theory evolved over the course of the case. The victim testified to more sexual contact than I think what the prosecutor had anticipated.
You're in agreement that the state law is that if it was a simultaneous touching, that that would be a single act?
Yes.
So shouldn't the jury have been advised that in order to divine the whether there's a simultaneous act or not, they need to make that determination?
Not unless it was a theory put forth at trial. I am not aware of any United States Supreme Court case, and again, we're in habeas land here, so we are governed by clearly established federal law as clearly dictated by the United States Supreme Court. That would say that a jury must be instructed on a fine point of state law when that fine point of state law was never presented as a possible defense theory at trial. So therefore, just to recap my argument, findings of fact by the state courts never clearly rebutted by Mr. Schweiner. Number two, no identification of a United States Supreme Court that would allow him to prevail here. And number three, as mentioned in our brief, we believe that if there was a constitutional error in the supplemental instruction, that error would have been harmless. This case really revolved on an issue of credibility, and the supplemental instruction had nothing to do with witness credibility. Mr. Schweiner does not dispute that the jury was properly instructed on witness credibility. And
it's a little hard to argue it's harmless when the jury specifically comes back and asks exactly the question that seems to be argued now, isn't it? I mean, they asked, are these distinct?
I would dispute that that the jury asked exactly the question that's presented before this court now. I don't think anybody in this courtroom really knows what the jury meant by that question.
Well, the first question is, would the touching of each body part constitute one or two separate charges toward the three sexual assaults? That's the precise issue that's being argued here.
No, because the precise issue before the court is whether the touching of the buttocks and vagina simultaneously, would that constitute one or two buttocks and vagina? The question by the jury was submitted in the disjunctive. Would a touching of the buttocks or the vagina constitute one or two sexual touchings? I'm not exactly sure what the jury meant by that. The jury could have been asking.
But I think that's plaintiff's argument, that we're not sure what they meant by it. And because they weren't given adequate instructions, aren't we left with the possibility that they were not deciding consistent with Wisconsin law?
Well, a couple of things. I'm slightly troubled by the prospect that a defendant could get habeas relief by virtue of the fact that we don't know exactly what a jury was thinking. If that's the standard for getting habeas relief, then the state criminal justice...
Well, I think it's more than that. We don't know what they were thinking about an issue in which they weren't properly instructed.
And on which it was never argued to the jury to be...
Understood.
My time is up. Thank you.
Thank you, Counsel.
Thank you, Mr. Neiser. Mr. Hannock.
Thank you. The only facts that were found by the Court of Appeals were that a jury could find that... this touching was separate. The Court of Appeals never found, at least that I can see, that they had to, that any reasonable jury necessarily had to find that these were separate. And as explained in my reply brief, it would have been unreasonable under Miller L. If the court had found that. We have Mark's testimony about the single, just grabbing and throwing. Reasonable jury could conclude from that. Easily that this was simultaneous.
What about the response that the trial judge never could have anticipated this instruction because it was never an argument, it was never a defense theory to begin with that they were parsing specific conduct with respect to one touching. It was a much broader claim, and then it would have, there's no way for the trial court to have even anticipated the need for this instruction.
And prior to the jury question, that would have been accurate, probably. But when we have the prosecutor's argument in closing, that is at best confusing about whether these are to be considered separately or together. And in the same sentence, he says both. And then we have a juror that thinks it's important whether or not it's separate, it's one or two. At that point, the judge should have known. In every criminal case, I do take oppose one thing that the, well, many, but one specific, is that a criminal defense in a case is not limited to what you specifically argue. If you're arguing alibi, that doesn't mean that the jury can convict you if
but I think
you're there. You still have to prove every fact beyond a reasonable doubt.
At the end of the day, though, are we? Is it essential that we would have to find plain error by the trial judge not to anticipate it, since nobody raised it, not to anticipate it, that that's what was really being asked by the jury and that they needed clarification on that aspect of the law?
Again, I think that plain error is I haven't researched this. This is the first time it came up. But my recollection from years of practicing, I think the plain error only applies on direct appeal. In habeas, we already have the much more restrictive standards of the anti-terrorism amendments. We have the I see my time is out.
You can answer.
Harmless error, a greater harmless error standard, waiver, things of that nature. So there's no reason to plug another heightened standard into that. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ms. Hanick. Thanks, both counsel. Ms. Hanick, I want to give you an additional thanks to the court for accepting this appointment.